Welcome to Moolala, Money Made Simple on SiriusXM. Here's your host, Bruce Sellery.
Hello, I'm Bruce Sellery. This is Moolala, Money Made Simple. What is that smell? We know what that smell is. Cannabis is now legal in Canada, and you can smell it and see it everywhere. But does that mean you should be seeing it in your portfolio? We'll look at some of the cannabis companies you might not have heard of. Patrick Wood of Tormont Group will be our guest. Many entrepreneurs dream about opening up their own business. Maybe these days that's a pot shop, I don't know. But they don't know where to begin. Maybe opening a franchise would make sense. Franchise consultant Gary Prenevost from FranNet will be here. He'll tell us all you need to know about franchising. Tim Hortons has a lot of franchises. Are you their very best customer? Stopping by every day and buying a caramel latte supreme? Is that why you can't pay off your credit card every month? Or is something else to blame? We'll talk to Mixed Up Money's Alyssa Fisher about what she sees as the biggest problem that Canadians face when it comes to money. We'll also talk about life insurance and mobile investing. So grab your big fat latte and listen up. Let's get started. Cannabis 2.0, the names you have never heard of. Now, you probably heard of Canopy Growth and Aurora, a bunch of other big names. But there's also a lot of other unique companies that might be interesting if you want to diversify your cannabis industry portfolio. Toronto-based advisory firm Tormont Group is bringing some U.S. players to Canada's markets. Patrick Wood is Tormont Group's CEO. Hello there.
Hey, how are you?
Big picture context. Cannabis is now legal in Canada. The big cannabis stocks had an enormous run-up and a bit of a pullback. Is now really the time for us to be talking about adding any stocks in this sector?
Yes, absolutely.
Why?
A couple of reasons. Just like any kind of revolution that happens in a new industry or a new technology, there's going to be a rotation to new companies and new innovation.
Is rotation a synonym for heads rolling through the streets, you know, the bloodbath that we have seen for some?
You know, if you look at the past, yes. And I think the same holds true. So if you look at the tech boom, it's not the right thing to compare this to, but it's the last thing that people remember very clearly. This happened over the last couple of decades. And you had a huge amount of companies come out in the HTML space. It was a very revolutionary, you know, kind of market movement at the time. And after all the carnage, you know, after everyone did lose their heads and, you know, people were jumping off of buildings, what came out of that were the real bellwethers, the ones that really made it in the long run, the Googles, the Amazons, et cetera, the companies we're all familiar with today. No one remembers 90% of the companies that were part of that tech boom that happened back in late 99, you know, 2000. So same's going to happen with cannabis.
You were
now
quoted on BNN Bloomberg recently saying that you think there's a day of reckoning on valuations. Is that just the pot producers or is this a sector?
That was very specifically directed toward the sector itself, more particularly around the producers. I mean, the producers make up most of the sector. Let's face it, Canopy, Aurora, Tilray, you know, Cronos. I mean, these are big growers. These are farmers. So the day of reckoning, you know what? We were pretty spot on with our timing there. Most of those companies are off 30-50% from that interview. And I think that's because, you know, there's enough of a trade, and the trade itself has kind of worn thin. So investors have now decided, look, you know, this is too much speculation. Tilray running from, you know, 17 a share up to 300, it was too, you know, in about a week's time, it was too much. And I think with any trade like that, you're going to have, you know, a huge exodus going in and a massive exodus running out. So what we're interested about is, where does the money go now?
Yeah. Right? I used to work in the packaged goods industry. I used to work on Pampers diapers. Hooray for me. And when you look at packaged goods, you know there's the marketers, there's the retailers, there's the transportation companies, there's the IT providers, there's the people who, you know, sell the raw materials. How do you carve up the bits and pieces of the cannabis industry? I'm sure there are some that are pretty integrated vertically, but many that are not. How do you carve up the little subgroups within that broad?
So it's a great question. And the first thing you do is you go to a place where cannabis has been sold for the last several years. And that's not Canada.
Amsterdam?
Well, Amsterdam. I wouldn't use that as the right
Washington
example.
Or Oregon.
I would use
Colorado.
Yeah, I would use Washington State and Colorado.
Okay.
I mean, they're the most gentrified and certainly the oldest of the rec states in the U.S. They've been selling cannabis
recreational.
Yeah, okay. Sorry. But they've been selling cannabis legally for over several years, and as such, everything that could evolve in that space has evolved there. So new innovations, new technologies, branding, distribution, things that we don't yet have in Canada. And what we have had, and it's a very strange dichotomy, Canada's raised all the money for farmers, essentially, but the real technologies, the real businesses have been created in the States. They've been running successfully in the States, and they've been navigating through this ecosystem that we have yet to even start with in Canada.
You were talking about the tech analogy. How do you identify the Amazons and avoid the pets.com?
Great question. Business model, management teams, absolutely. You know, is it a business that makes sense? Is it scalable enough? And is it innovative enough that it has the valuation to it? And let's face it, a lot of this does come down to valuation. You know, Canopy, Tilray, et cetera. I mean, the valuations for these companies to actually sustain their share prices at this level is way out of whack with reality.
Which isn't a commentary on their business or their business prospects.
Not at all.
Or on
management or on board or anything like that. It's just the fact that this was the first real a way that investors globally could invest in cannabis. So now we've said, look, let's look at these industries that have been operating successfully in the space, that have very cheap valuations, that have great business models going forward. Why don't we bring those companies to Canada? And that's what Tormont Group does. We identify who those companies are in those states where they've been operating federally compliant, by the way, because we only look at companies that are 100% federally compliant. We're not interested in border issues and all that kind of stuff.
Right.
But as such, you know, once again, a company, you know, that creates software and that has been successfully marketing software and selling it within those states is something we want to know about.
We've got two names that you're celebrating or selling or whatever you call it. For Canadian investors, they can't buy shares in these companies.
Not yet. So we have right now several companies in the U.S. who we are actively about to take public in Canada through the CPC and RTO listing process in Canada.
So RTO?
Reverse takeover process in Canada. So
they'll buy a mining company?
I'm sorry?
They'll buy a mining company?
No, not necessarily. In our case, what we look for is specifically TSX Venture companies. And the TSX Venture has a great program called the CPC, which is called short for the Capital Pool Company Program. And it's essentially the creation of a shell that at some point that shell needs to make a qualifying transaction. And that qualifying transaction is essentially reverse takeover. So the shell actually issues shares to the U.S. company in this case that's
right.
Coming in to go public.
So one of the companies is POS a bit.
Posabit.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I'm assuming POS is point of sale?
Yeah. Well, it stands for point of sale a bit.
Of sale a bit. Okay. All right. Okay. So here's my cynical side. I looked at their website and they have the cannabis reference, that they do POS for cannabis retailers. It sounds very much like when the companies just added .com to their name back in the late 90s, or when they added crypto to their name like a year and a half ago. Is that what's happening here?
Yeah, no, not at all. So Posabit, if you look at a recreational state today and you go into a dispensary to acquire cannabis, you are essentially dealing with a cash business because it's still federally legal. It's still a Schedule I drug in the U.S. Banks, credit unions, I should say a lot of credit unions are probably some of these guys' best friends, but banks, credit card companies are adamantly refusing to do transactions within that ecosystem. So what Posabit has done is they've developed a very, very innovative and leading edge workaround to that. And it's a payment solution that uses crypto at the point of sale that if you come in to buy, let's say, your cannabis at a store, you can now use your credit or debit card to acquire, in this case, Litecoin. And Posabit prints out a quick little wallet. It's a paper-based wallet. That paper-based wallet is then used to acquire your cannabis right at point of sale. So it's a quick 5-second transaction, but it's two transactions. It is a workaround to the lack of debit and credit use in the stores.
And why is that an opportunity in Canada? Because here, well, it's legal, transact away.
Yeah, well, you know what? Who knows what will happen in Canada and where POSIBIT will fit in Canada. The opportunity in Canada is the fact that POSIBIT will be listed here and trading here.
So they may not do any business here.
I would say probably not. It's not in their business plan at this stage. But I'll tell you this. I mean, next year, just on a pro forma basis, they're going to be coming out in the marketplace at less than 2x on their top line sales. So if you compare that to anything else out there, you're talking about a very, very cheap multiple on what essentially is a technology company.
MetaCan is another name. What's that?
Yeah, very, very cool company. MetaCan has probably, they certainly have, from what we know, the only Controlled Substances Act, DEA, and FDA compliant CBD product that's currently sold in over 2,000 stores across the U.S. And MetaCan is very compelling to us because it is the only CBD product that actually...
CBD? So
CBD is, well, there are two types of derivatives from the
versus
cannabis
THC?
Plant. Yeah, THC is
Listen
the stuff
to me.
That...
I'm so schooled.
You know what? We wouldn't be having this conversation if we had THC right now, but if we had some CBD...
We could do that?
Yeah, we'd feel pretty great.
My chronic
pain
would disappear, which I do not have?
Yeah, you know what? I don't know if it works for everybody, but certainly the studies, and there have been over 1,000 of them, they all say that, you know what, it works very, very well. And it not only helps with chronic pain, it can be an absolute solution to the opioid crisis. You name it, there are many, many uses there. But what really is exciting about MetaCan is the fact that their product is the only one that kind of checks all the boxes off. So they will be, you know, as a partner to a large company at some point, they're the absolute perfect solution.
Right.
Not only that, you know, that market for CBD, if you go to Google Trends as an example, CBD is the only thing that over the last, you know, several years has continuously gone up.
You know, my takeaway from our conversation is just how much thinking needs to go into this space. This is not one that one can buy without doing the due diligence on the specific part of the business these companies are engaging in.
Yeah, you're absolutely spot on.
Interesting. Patrick, thank you for your time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Patrick Wood is the CEO of Tormont Group.
You're listening to Moolah La, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Spending $5 a day on a caramel vanilla latte or something like that might make you feel a little guilty, knowing you could have saved that money by just making a cup at home with a cheap bottle of vanilla syrup. But perhaps coffee isn't your problem when it comes to your money. Digital currency could be, in fact. Alyssa Fisher is a personal finance blogger and creator of Mixed Up Money. She is here to talk about the problems with digital currency and the what's another dollar mindset. She joins us from Fort McMurray, Alberta. Hello there.
Hi, how's it going?
Tell us a bit about your blog. What inspired Mixed Up Money?
For sure. So I started the blog in 2015. Basically, at that time in my life, I started working for a not-for-profit organization that specialized in helping people get out of debt. And the ironic part was that I, myself, had amassed over $10,000 of debt.
Insert gasp here. Insert.
Yes. And that's not even like an excessive amount these days. So I started the blog basically just to hold myself accountable for the goal of becoming debt-free.
And how'd it go?
And it went great. I actually managed to pay off all the debt in under 1 year.
Congratulations.
And yeah, it was a great feeling. So, and now I just continue to do it for fun. I love it. I love the community that there is in personal finance and getting to share some of my knowledge.
Yeah, it's a great community. Hey, folks are generous, they are wise, and they're sparkly and fun, I would venture to say. You wrote a recent post on digital currency. Tell us what you wanted to get at there.
Oh, yes. Recently, I just had a baby.
Congratulations again.
Thank you. Basically, while I've been on maternity leave, I've kind of been finding different ways to treat myself because I've been a little bit short on time, and digital currency has become a really regular part of my life. I go to Starbucks all the time. I use the app because I hate waiting in line, and things like skip the dishes or click and collect from grocery stores, all of those things have become my new best friend. So I wrote the blog post basically just to touch on that.
Is there a but here? Am I preparing myself for a but?
I don't know if there's a but. I did find out that I was spending around $3 a day on Starbucks coffee.
That's a cheap coffee at Starbucks.
I wasn't going every day, but I mean, on average, that's a little bit too much spending on coffee, in my opinion.
Right, right. Well, and one of the challenges, I mean, I talk about this a lot. It is a super simple way to transact. It makes it very, very easy. It is friction-free. But there's a trade-off to that. There are some consequences of that. When you talk about the Starbucks app or any app like that, do you find that it makes it more difficult for you to budget?
Oh, absolutely. I think because I don't have cash these days. I don't think a lot of people do carry cash these days. And so when you'd use an app like that, you can't actually see the money leaving your bank account or leaving your wallet.
And how do you feel about apps that give you rewards every time you spend a certain amount of money? It's much more automated than those old little, you know, coffee cards that they would stamp a little hole in. And you're probably too young for this. But there was a time in the past when that's how they did rewards programs.
No, I actually love the rewards aspect. And I do get quite a few coffees because I am a loyal Starbucks customer. And then as well as like things like click and collect at Superstore, I'm one of the people that don't grocery shop anymore. I just order my groceries online and go pick them up. But I've gotten a lot of points this way, and I actually have over $100 in free groceries waiting for me right now.
Are there downsides? You sound to be very, very supportive of these options. I'm thinking, what's happened?
I'm supportive of the fact that it's that I like to treat myself every once in a while, and I don't think there's anything wrong with that, if you can afford to. But I do think the problem is that you don't ask yourself, what's another dollar? Every single time you buy something, you just kind of get stuck in that cycle and you become really comfortable with an extra $5 here and $10 there. And you fall down into this rabbit hole of like, how am I ever going to save money again? Because you didn't even realize how much you were spending in the first place.
Have there been times where you get concerned about how simple the functionality is on the services that you are using and think, oh, geez, like it actually would be much easier if I just went all 2005 and showed up at a grocery store by myself with $50 in cash?
Yeah, absolutely. Like, I think it's easier to budget for sure if you're just sticking to cash, even the putting money into an envelope and only using what you have for that category each month. I think that's a lot easier to budget, definitely, and a lot smarter if you're trying to save cash.
How do you personally navigate the cost benefit on the rewards front? Because we know marketers, the only reason they give you rewards is to sell you more stuff. It's not because they think you're nice. It's not because they want to make you happy. It's because they want to sell you more stuff. So how do you manage your own behavior given that enticement?
For sure. So for things like groceries, I think when it comes to rewards points, I usually buy based on what is going to give me points that week. Like, I don't meal plan until I've seen kind of what's available that week, and then I would buy things in bulk that are on sale.
Right. So every meal's including cauliflower because it was $2.50
yeah,
ahead.
Exactly. Hey, you can make a lot of meals with cauliflower.
You can. Cauliflower is amazing.
But just things like that. And then as far as the coffee goes, like if you do have your free drink coming, then maybe that's the day you decide you're going to get a venti instead of a tall coffee.
So as personal finance nerds, we know that there was this thing called the latte factor. It's one of those books that people, you know, if you just stop drinking that latte, you'd be a gazillionaire in 5 minutes. Do you believe or disbelieve that as a view?
I am anti-latte factor. I think that you should spend on what works for you. When I first started writing about money, I was very critical of other people's spending, but I've soon realized that that's not entirely fair. Sometimes if you're having a bad week, you need to spend that $5 on a coffee.
Yeah, and a coffee's better than a line of cocaine, which is more expensive than that. I don't know how much that actually is because I'm not a user, but it, you know, other people might make that choice.
Definitely. And I think your employer might be a little bit upset if you fall asleep at your desk because you missed your morning coffee.
Yes. Yes. I thought so you were going to say can, because you missed your line of coke. You wouldn't be asleep. You'd be fine.
No.
On the energy front, no. You'd be fine. How do you engage with the readers of your blog? What do you find that you love to hear from them? And what do you find is like, okay, I need to block you?
Honestly, a lot of my readers are really interested in just kind of listening about what the mistakes I've made have been like, because I am far from perfect when it comes to talking about personal finance and managing my own money. So a lot of the times we kind of banter back and forth about all the mistakes we've made and what we can do to make that better, which is one of the reasons that I've continued to do this. One of the things I don't like is when people are critical and judgmental of how I spend my money, because I guess it's my fault for putting it out there, but I'm trying to make it a little less taboo and a little bit more easy for people to understand that it's okay if you make a mistake with your money.
Yeah, and it is your money. You can do whatever you want with it. Well, Alyssa, thank you for joining us and telling us a bit about your blog and how you are making life work. How old is your baby now?
She's 5 months.
5 months. Oh, my gosh. When I had a child that age, I needed like a carton of concealer to apply to my face every single day. I am sure this is why I'm in radio now with young children. It's just much easier than television. Thank you very much, Alyssa.
Thanks so much.
Alyssa Fisher, personal finance blogger and creator of Mixed Up Money. We're talking about some of the things that she loves to talk about on her blog. Coming up next on Moolala, franchising with FranNet's Gary Prenevost. And later, J.D. Power's Mike Foy will be here. We find out how satisfied Canadians are with their investment firm's mobile app. This isn't enough Moolala for you, and I'm sure it is not. Come on, download and subscribe to the podcast version of our show on iTunes. You can also listen to it on Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, and Google Play. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Listening to Moolala, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
We cover all aspects of Moolala on this show. Saving, spending, investing, and periodically we talk about earning. For some people, that doesn't mean getting a better job to earn more. It means starting a business. And starting a business can be a scary prospect. It can be a risky prospect too. One avenue that some people consider is investing in a franchise. But how does that actually work? Gary Prenevost is a franchise consultant at FranNet, and he joins us now to talk franchising. Hello there.
Hello.
Is there a lot of, I don't know, baggage around franchising in our culture? Like, as the word was coming out of my mouth, I was kind of like, oh, that sounds a little bit like multi-level marketing, even though I know so much of retail works that way.
There are certain perceptions, and most people think of franchising as food and retail. It's the visible face of franchising, bricks and mortar, and they also think it's more expensive because it's bricks and mortar. But that only represents about 40% of the industry.
What's the rest?
Just about everything else. There's 60
services,
different
services. A lot of services.
There's home services, residential, commercial. There's 60 different industries in franchising.
How do you come to this world? What was the background that brought you here, and what does FranNet do today?
I was a franchisor. I bought my first franchise when I was 31 years old, sales management leadership training, eventually built and then became the franchisor with my ex-partner. When I divested of that business, I bought FranNet. That was almost 18 years ago.
And what does FranNet do?
We're a franchise matchmaking and consulting firm, so we help people figure out whether
they should swipe right not.
If number one, if they should even really seriously investigate franchising, it's not right for everybody. Matter of fact, some people going into business is exactly the wrong thing to do. So people come to us, I want to be in my own business, I don't know what I want, I don't know what my options are, I don't know what to look at. We help them figure that out.
In two sentences, what is franchising?
Franchising is a business license that you get to work with the franchisor. They support you in the business, the coaching, the marketing, all of that, in exchange for they're going to get royalties, the initial franchise fee. But essentially, they compress time. Compared to starting a business from scratch, a good franchise system will compress time.
And there should be real scale on the marketing front, like opening up a donut shop versus opening up a Tim Hortons franchise. You arrive with a big brand and a whole bunch of infrastructure and all that stuff at a cost.
Yes, but not always.
Ooh, okay. What do you mean?
Well, just because something is franchised, Bruce, it doesn't mean it's been good. It means it's been duplicated. So there are good business systems out there. There are mature, good business systems. There are systems out there that the franchisor is early entry. So depending on the level of system sophistication, there's different levels of risk.
Tim Hortons, I use that example because, one, we're consumers of that business, many of us, periodically. If you drive on the highway, you have no choice. And second, because it's been in the news, in particular with the franchise fight, right? Like not just the takeover of the Brazilian company, but the franchisor fight. What's your take on that whole thing through the lens that you see the world?
Well, I look at the relationship with between Tim's and their 3G. You know, it's awkward for the industry to see it happen, but there are a lot of happy Tim's franchisees, as they are with any other system. It is not reflective of what's happening overall in the industry.
You said for some people franchising is the right thing, for some it's the wrong thing. Yep. What are your top three reasons you'd say who is it right for? What are three characteristics of people who it is right for?
I think the first thing is that people have to be comfortable with a permanent level of risk. I'm not talking large risk, but being in business, there's always variable elements. So if somebody's looking for a guaranteed paycheck, shouldn't be considering franchising.
Yeah.
The patience and tenacity are traits that this is when you look at compared to employment, getting a job these days, unless you're in government or union environments where there's a lot more security, it's usually a 1 to 2 year strategy. Yep. Buying a franchise is a 5 to 10 year strategy or better, longer.
Yep.
So people have to be looking at the long term. I give up a year or two of income while I build the business, but then I've got a very consistent permanent income if I run the business well for many years.
Those two things, though, sound like they would apply to anyone considering an entrepreneurial venture versus one who's considering franchising, which is a particular type of entrepreneurial venture. Is there anything that would further distinguish what would have you open up a Tim's franchise versus a local donut shop that you bake from grandma's recipe?
Granted, being with a franchise, there is a certain level of systems and processes that one has to follow. If somebody does not like structure, then franchising is probably not a good place for them. Having said that, there are franchisors with very little structure compared to the Tim's or the McDonald's of the world where there's a lot of structure. So it's very situational.
How capital intensive is a franchised donut shop versus a, hey, I got a lease on a place at a local strip mall and I'm just going to put out my shingle?
I think to say a donut shop, it'd be better to give a perspective of the entire industry. There's service franchises out there that you can buy and invest for under $100,000. Then you get into bricks and mortar where it's location based. It could be $250,000 to $500,000. The big premium brands can be into the millions.
Right, right. And there are ones, I mean, I remember College Pro Painters, right? Students would start that thing up for 4 months and maybe they'd never do it again and they could still make a reasonable amount of money.
Yeah.
What sets off your BS alarm? Knowing that there are so many companies selling franchises to so many wide-eyed, eager, entrepreneurial, excited, passionate people, what's your like,
There's four critical levels of what I think make up a good franchise system. Number one, the franchisor has financial strength that's deep enough to help the system grow. Prospective franchisees can see that their annual statements in the disclosure document. Next level of importance, in escalating importance, is that the franchisor has the business experience to run the business. Plus, they have the leadership experience to support and manage a franchise system, which is very different than running the business. Third, escalating importance is they're on the right trend versus fad, something that's sustainable long term. And fourth, which trumps everything else, is, and this is what really sets up off the BS alarm, if enough of the franchisees aren't happy enough, and there's always going to be unhappy franchisees, but if it's a small percentage, if the majority of the franchisees are meeting and exceeding what they expected to meet, that's usually the indicator of a good
system.
How
do you find that out? Are they like online chat groups or do you walk into the store and casually ask someone?
It usually takes about 40 to 50 physical hours to research a franchise. And talking to existing franchisees, you should talk to at least 8 to 10 existing franchisees within the system, one-third top performers, one-third middle, and one-third unhappies. And you find out who the middle and the top performers are from the other franchisees as you're talking to them.
Now, you've been doing a lot of speaking on this topic. You discuss 9 critical rules to buying the optimum franchise. One of those rules is ride only one horse. Mm-hmm. What do you mean by that?
Too many people go into business, they think about, I'll get the business part-time. And I'll run it part-time. Once I can get it to a point where it's successful, then I'll leave my full-time job and then go into the business. That's essentially riding two horses. The full-time business or right. The full-time job is the fully trained thoroughbred. The business is like a young Bronco, never had a saddle on it before. It's a crazy ride. And most people can't do that well. So if you're going to go into business for yourself, take the time and expect to go into it full-time once you start.
Do you have a second favorite critical rule that you could talk about all day long and never get tired of it?
Yes, that's my first rule, which is know thyself. What are the skills? What are the interests? What are the financial and lifestyle resources and goals? See, a lot of people, they look at what is it going to take to buy the business, and they don't look at enough of how well can I run it. So understanding what you bring to the table, and then can the business achieve your financial and lifestyle goals short-term and long-term? That's where most people, they let the market dictate their opportunities instead of them figuring out what they have first.
What are some of the funding options available for people who want to open up a franchise?
The most typical one, if it's bricks and mortar, will be the Canada Small Business Finance Program, which can finance up to $350,000. It's 75% guaranteed by the government, but there are restrictions to that. The next most popular one, especially service businesses, is home equity lines of credit. A lot harder to get nowadays with the new mortgage rules. Bank of mom and dad, millennials, multi-generational financing. Those are the other ones. And
Do you have an itch to go back into this yourself, or are you just happy to provide advice?
I've actually done it a couple of times.
Really?
And I've divested of those businesses. This is what I love to do. It's a perfect place for me.
All the best without any of the worst. Gary, thanks for your time.
Thank you very much.
Gary Penevoe is a franchise consultant at Franet. He was here to talk about some of the pros and cons, risks, and things you should think about before you embark on the path towards being a franchisee. Stay with us. Coming up later, we'll take you through the Moolala questionnaire with blogger Alyssa Fisher of Mixed Up Money. But next, we'll look at the many life insurance policies available to Canadians with Lauren Marr. He's with LSM Insurance. Now, if you have a question about money, it may be that I have already answered it somewhere. I'm the money columnist for Money Sense, and you can scroll through some of the columns that I've written at moneysense.ca. Then search for my name. Stay with us. There's more Moolala after the break.
Listening to Moolala, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
I like our next guest. I don't like his favorite topic, life insurance. Not because it makes me think of my own mortality, I'm going to live forever, but because it's complicated and it's about minimizing downside risk versus optimizing upside opportunity. But it's really important, so we have to talk about it. So we're doing the interview, and I'm going to treat myself to a brownie afterwards as a reward. How's that? Lauren Marr is here to navigate the different types of life insurance policies out there. He is the Director of Business Development at LSM Insurance. Hi there, Lauren.
Hey, Bruce.
How was that for an introduction? I hope I didn't insult you in any way.
No, it was good.
Phew. You published a very simple chart about life insurance, which is why you're here today. The very first classification on this chart that was on your site is about the length of coverage. And this seems to start here, term life versus permanent life. Tell us the difference.
Well, I think that's where it kind of starts. Is there's two types of life insurance, term and permanent. So the term, The coverage is for a temporary period of time, and the rates start off lower, and then they go up as you get older. And then the permanent, the rates generally are level for life, but start off higher, and the coverage stays with you for life. Now, within each of those categories, there are subcategories, and we can talk about that more. Yeah. Like, for example, a term policy has a 10-year term, 20-year term, et cetera, and then there's subcategories for the permanent as well.
I am a big believer in life insurance as a product, in particular for anyone who has children, and largely because its original intention was to protect against calamity. And that's fundamentally the purpose of it. I'm not a big fan in general for insurance as a part of an investment portfolio, though I know it works for some people, and for some people it's tax planning. For whom is a permanent life policy a good fit, broadly speaking?
Yeah, so a permanent policy can be a good fit in a few instances. One, it can be a good fit for someone who wants to look at estate planning. An example might be, you know, someone that has like a family cottage that they want to pass on to their children. Could trigger a large capital gain, so they can do a permanent type plan that where it can either pay out on the passing of one person, or they have something called a last to die type policy where it pays out on the second spouse passing away, because that's when most of the tax would be triggered in terms of something like that. It could be good for a family business, someone who wants to do any type of charitable giving, someone who may just want to increase the value of their overall estate with a secure asset may want to look at adding some permanent life insurance. Some people without a lot of assets may want to look at having something for final expenses. So those are a few examples of where permanent life insurance might be a fit.
We talk about fees on this program in all different categories of people's financial life because it's super important for things to be transparent. How much does an insurance broker make on a term policy versus on a permanent policy? What's the simple way, and I know it's tough, but what is the simplest way to do an apples to apples? And it's important because I think that could color the recommendation that a broker might make.
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, keep in mind, definitely on a there's two things that are going to impact the commission rate on a policy. And the first is the size of the premium. So the size of the premium on a permanent on a term policy is going to be much less for a given amount of coverage than the size of premium on a permanent policy. So that's the first variable. The second variable is what they call like a first-year commission rate. And generally, with most permanent policies, it's higher than on term policies. There are some exceptions to that. The first-year commission rate may be lower on a term 100-type policy, which is falls under that permanent classification where the rates are level for life, but there's no cash values. But one thing to keep in mind with the commission rate is that if you do, for example, a 10-year term and you need the insurance for 30 years or even longer, you may decide to start, you know, you need it for 10 years and then you may need it for a lifetime depending on what your needs are. So the commission would be paying out each time you take out a new term policy. Or if you start off with a term policy and convert it down the road, whereas with a permanent policy, there's basically the needs, you're covering that cost one time, or you're paying that commission one time, because you're only buying the policy once if you keep it.
Who makes more money, the broker that deals exclusively in term, or the broker that deals exclusively in permanent policies?
Well, I guess, I mean, The way to answer that is a good broker wouldn't deal exclusively in either.
No, I know that. Really, the question you haven't answered that I'm trying to get to is from a broker's standpoint.
If you're selling just the term, you're going to make less. There's no question. But to keep in mind that, you know, if you sell someone a term down the road, there's a good chance they're either going to want a new term or a permanent. So if you were to look at someone who just sold term or just sold permanent, they'd make less if they sold just term or more if they sold permanent, although either one probably wouldn't sell that much life insurance because they wouldn't be doing a full picture plan.
Yeah, and I know that everyone needs to, you know, address the needs of the client and all that stuff. In the investing space, there is a big difference between selling an exchange-traded fund and selling a high-fee Canadian equity fund, and there are reasons to do so, but it's an important part of the financial mosaic.
Yeah, I agree. That although this would be maybe a little bit different because both of those funds would potentially cover a specific requirement, whereas one policy may not cover a specific requirement on the life insurance side. So that's may not be an apple to apple comparison, but I see where you're coming from.
Yeah, and there is no simple comparison. I just want to just include that.
Sure.
And if someone's engaging with their brokers, the awesome brokers out there will say, "Here's the deal. Here's how my commission works, and here's how the commission would work if I sell you that other product." All good. Want to make sure it's going to work for you, and you move on. It's good.
Yeah,
you can also classify life insurance by medical exam requirements. What are some of the options out there?
Yeah, so there's been a shift in the industry the last few years towards simplified issue type policies. And traditionally, you know, you'd have your fully underwritten plans where there's a medical, nurse comes to see you, they ask a whole list of health questions, and then there was a simplified issue or no medical type policies. Those no medical type policies were really, if you look back 5 or 10 years ago, they were just for the hard to insure market, but you know, people with serious health issues. But in recent years, more companies have gone to simplified issue even for healthy individuals. And there seems to be a shift, especially among some younger people who don't want all the hassles of having to meet with a nurse, having to, you know, wait a long time for their insurance. A lot of those people are going the way of simplified issue policies. And in some instances, there's only a small difference in the premium between, say, you know, a $500,000 Term 20 fully underwritten policy and a $500,000 Term 20 simplified issue policy. There might only be a difference of, you know, $2 a month, and some people may not, you know, want to go through those extra hoops.
Interesting.
To potentially save that money.
Really appreciate your time, Lauren. I we could talk about this for another hour, but I'm afraid that is an hour that we do not have today.
Okay, great. Well, it's my pleasure talking to you, and I hope to talk to you again soon.
Lauren Mars, Director of Business Development at LSM Insurance. And when we're talking about life insurance, if you have kids, you need it. And secondly, my second point is if you're looking at life insurance, become a temporary expert, invest the time because it will be worth it. And you don't have to stay up to speed. Just get that policy, get her done. Stay with us. Coming up next, do the apps deserve the snaps? Canadians and the mobile experience they get from their investment firm. J.D. Powers, Mike Foy will be here. And we'll take Alyssa Fisher from Mixed Up Money through the Moolala questionnaire. If you prefer TV to radio, I'm the money columnist for CityLine. It is a national lifestyle show on air across North America. And you can find more segments on me and decorating and fashion and food and all sorts of amazing things at cityline.ca. Stick around. We'll be back after the break.
Listening to Moolah La, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
We use our phones for everything. We text, we email, we Snapchat, we Facebook, we listen to music. Maybe once or twice a month we use it for a phone call. Unless you're under 27, then you don't even know it has a phone function on it. We also use it for things like banking and investing, many of us. But how satisfied are Canadians with their investment firm's mobile app? The J.D. Power Self-Directed Investor Satisfaction Study revealed investment firms don't hit the mark when it comes to their investors' mobile experience. Mike Foy is Senior Director of the Wealth Management Practice at J.D. Power, and he joins us now to tell us more about the study. Hello there.
Hi, Bruce. How are you?
Why do a study like this? Why is that an important thing to research?
Well, so this is a study that J.D. Power does that really tries to understand more holistically about investors' satisfaction with their brokerage firm. So we really look at all aspects of the experience they have, whether it's the website, a call center experience, their satisfaction with their statement, the fees they pay. But one of the things that we've started to pay a lot more attention to is the mobile experience. As you said, it's become a much more important part of consumers' lives. And so we've started to take a deeper dive about how they feel about the mobile experience they're having from their investment providers.
And the most important reader of this research, if I'm correct, is the companies that the investment firms that offer these apps and these websites and those sorts of things. Is that fair?
Yeah, so absolutely. I mean, obviously, we try to provide some transparency for the individual consumer or investor to understand who's doing a good job and who's not. But yes, our research is also used by the firms in order to understand more about how their consumers feel, how they're performing relative to their competitors, and really where they should focus their efforts to improve their customer experience.
So the people at BMO InvestorLine are high-fiving themselves because they came out on top in your survey, correct?
That's exactly right.
They Why? Did, yeah. What did they do that had them shine above?
So they did a number of things well. So again, as I mentioned, we the survey is very sort of robust and holistic in terms of the different areas of the investor experience that we look at. Specifically with BMO Investor Line, there's a couple of things that they do particularly well. So they scored very highly on areas like products and services offerings, information resources, investment performance, channel interaction. So really, by and large, they had a very strong showing across most of the aspects of our study.
How do you determine what the variables are that consumers can vote on? And I ask because I am a huge believer in the magic of behavioral economics. And in some ways, financial services firms are embracing that thinking, even though it's decades old. And in some cases, they really are not. But I think consumers, investors have a hard time. They wouldn't be able to articulate, wow, they helped me save more tomorrow based on Thaler. They wouldn't be able to articulate that. How would apps that are great at the BE side, how would satisfaction show up for them?
So, I mean, specifically with respect to apps, I mean, we look at a number of things about not only we ask them how satisfied were they with the app experience, but we also ask them about different transactions they performed on the app and how satisfied they were with those transactions compared to performing them in other channels, right? So we ask them not only about trade execution, but also about things like reviewing your account history, managing a stock watch list, transferring funds, paying bills, making deposits, and really looking at not only what are they doing, what kind of functionality are they using, but what areas are providing positive experiences relative to alternative channels that they could use for those things, like the website or like, going into a branch or picking up the phone to do them.
The study found that investors seem to be getting more fee sensitive when choosing a firm. And at the same time, there's a need for greater fee transparency. What else would you say you infer from your study on the fee topic?
Yeah, so I think the transparency issue is a big one. You know, that's gotten a lot of attention within the industry over the past 3 years because of, CRM2 and a lot of disclosure requirements. What we've kind of been tracking in our studies in Canada is that despite all the industry attention, most clients really haven't noticed anything different from their firms. And the number of clients that say they completely understand their fees has really been flat or at best increasing very modestly. So there's still a huge opportunity, I think, for firms to better educate their clients on what they're paying and the value they're getting for what they're paying. We find that when clients really understand, they're much more satisfied with their fees and they're much more satisfied ultimately with their provider. And as you say, I mean, we do see fees are a big driver of firm selection, particularly among more active traders and among younger investors that we see increasingly open to looking at alternative providers for investments and not simply defaulting to stay with their retail banking provider.
You are based in New York City. J.D. Power does lots of different research in lots of different areas. How does Canada compare? So if you were to talk about these satisfaction results in the context of others that you have done in the U.S. in particular, are we good or not so good? I think Canadians love to say that we pay more for telecom, we pay more for mutual funds, and we don't have an expectation that our apps are particularly competitive globally. What does the research say?
Yeah, so I think we do see a lot of the same broad trends in the U.S. as in Canada. I think that obviously it's a bit of a different competitive landscape with the banks in Canada being dominant players across financial services looks a little bit different in the U.S. As far as the mobile experience specifically, though, with the exception of a few outliers in the U.S., generally speaking, I'd say that the U.S. and Canada in wealth management, at least, are in a pretty similar place, which is trailing what other industries are doing from a mobile experience perspective and really having a lot of catching up to do in terms of meeting their customer expectations when it comes to mobile.
Well, maybe your study will be a prompt, and we'll all thank you for it down the line. Mike, thank you for your time.
Thank you, Bruce. Appreciate it.
Mike Foy, Senior Director of the Wealth Management Practice at J.D. Power. He was here to talk about a recent study that they have fielded on self-directed investor satisfaction. Time now for the Moolah La Questionnaire. Our guest is Alyssa Fisher. She writes a blog called Mixed Up Money, and we are speaking to her from Fort McMurray, Alberta. Alyssa, just the first thing that comes to your mind. Are you ready?
I am ready.
How would you describe your money personality?
You do you.
You do you. Oh, I love that. What does you do you mean? I mean, I've heard the phrase, but what does it mean to you?
I think it means that everybody has a very unique financial situation, and whatever works for you isn't going to work for me. So I will stay in my lane and you stay in yours.
Oh, that's good. Who was your money mentor growing up?
Growing up, I would definitely say my dad. He worked super hard to provide for our family, and he taught me a lot of lessons about budgeting.
What would be one of the values that you would say he imprinted on you that you might not have appreciated at the time, but now you're grateful?
Oh, my favorite. You can't have your McDonald's toy until you finish the entire meal, which basically taught me to never buy something that I wasn't going to use or finish.
Right. What has been your best financial move in your life to date?
Hands down, paying off my debt. Living debt-free has completely changed my outlook on finances.
Wow. What was your worst? What was your worst financial move?
Oh, anytime I took a cash advance out on my credit card.
Yep.
I had no idea how bad that was.
What is one thing you worry about still when it comes to money?
I still worry about retirement and saving for the future and whether I'll have enough money, and who doesn't.
That's exactly right. Who doesn't? Even multimillion. I speak to a lot of high net worth individuals, and it's so funny to see how the worries broadly, the worries are very, very similar, regardless of the income that you have. It's so interesting.
I bet.
What is one of your guiltiest spending pleasures?
Oh, 100% coffee. And I also spend a lot of money on the iTunes store.
Ooh, okay. Do you buy music or TV series?
Well, I pay for the family membership for music, and then I buy a lot of apps.
You buy a lot of apps. What is one app recently that you thought, this is so worth the money that I have spent?
Oh, man. When I was delusional parenting with a newborn, I thought it would be a good idea to spend $6 on a photo app for my baby.
What does that even mean? What's a photo app? It's called a phone. It's already in your phone.
Yeah, I wish I could tell you, but I think
you don't even know. But you've that $6 you're never getting back. What is one of your favorite personal finance books or bloggers or columns or TV shows? What has been formative for you in your path?
I love Preet Banerjee's book, Stop Overthinking Your Money. That was one of the first ones I read.
I
love, as far as blogs go, Money After Graduation, Bridget Casey.
Yes, another Albertan. I know them both. Lovely human beings. If you were to land a financial windfall, a huge financial windfall, say $25 million, what would you do with it?
Oh, I would obviously invest some because I'm so boring.
Right.
And I would definitely share with family.
What is one money topic you could write about every single day without getting bored?
I honestly could write about debt every single day. There is never a dull moment when it comes to that. And there's always so many people going through that and have great stories to share.
And what is one topic you wish you never, ever, ever had to write about? Ever?
Oh, investing, because it's still terrifying to me.
Ah, okay. Interesting. Now, you live in Fort McMurray, Alberta, which is a, I've been there. There's a whole lot going on. A lot has changed in Fort Mac in the last 5 years or so.
Is there a
particular thing that you would say about personal finance in that community that might be different from the time that you lived in Alberta? I know the heyday, as we knew it 5 years ago, has passed and people weren't, dropping thousands of dollars at the bar like they might have been in that time. But what would you say is a little bit different living in that community that we might not know about?
You know what? It is very money focused here. In Calgary, when I lived there, people just kind of kept to themselves and didn't really release information about their income or how much they spent on this or where they were traveling on their next vacation. But here I find that everyone wants to talk about it and people will tell you how much they're making and they want to know how much you're making. And it's just a lot more money focused than anywhere I've ever lived.
Just a different culture. Well, Alyssa, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me. It was awesome.
Alyssa Fisher writes a blog called Mixed Up Money. She has an extraordinarily gorgeous five-month-old. I don't know that to be true, but five-month-olds are gorgeous, period, full stop. So I'm sure that's a good focus for her day. That is our program for today. If you would like some more Moolala, you can go to our website, moolala.ca, or head over to iTunes where you can download the full podcast, write a review, or subscribe to the next episode so it'll just arrive onto your device. What'd you think of today's program? I thought it was pretty good. Did you think it was pretty good? You might have thoughts, questions, comments. Ask at moolala.ca is our email address. Ask at moolala.ca. Thanks for joining us. Have a great day.